Welcome to the Bibliopod, Maclean's Magazine's books podcast for the weekend of August 21st. In this episode, we will discuss the cult of Amazon, the place it has in our culture, why it repels and fascinates us. And we'll also talk to Louise Penny, the Canadian author of the internationally best-selling Three Pines Mysteries. I'm Brian Bethune, a writer at Maclean's.
And I'm Anne Kingston, a writer at Maclean's.
It's been a week of news about Amazon, sparked by an expose in the New York Times about what an awful place it is to work. Unless you're one of Amazon's defenders who have said what a wonderful place it is. We're going to talk about that and about the extra buzz that's given to an already widely anticipated novel by a former Amazon editor. A Window Opens was expected to mock Amazon. We'll see if it does. The New York Times article had 5,700 responses within 3 days. So why do we care about what's going on in Amazon, Anne?
Well, I think that Amazon, in a way, is a template for a culture that's based on metrics, and that's creeping into every aspect of our lives. But Amazon has just done it bigger and bolder and first, so that in a way, we're fascinated by any culture of secrecy, which of course Amazon is.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like Scientology. We're fascinated with that as well, and there are certain similarities between the levels and various other aspects of Amazon that revealed in this piece that ran in the New York Times last week. But at the same time, I think we can relate to it in a way. We're not members of Scientology, but we are members of Amazon, at least anybody
who's gone on. It's got a real people like us vibe to it, both because we live in the book world and Amazon, however many refrigerators or wheelbarrows it'll sell you now, is still rooted in the book world. And that's the main reason I think we care about it. And because, and we're talking about the white-collar world, their warehouse life is brutal beyond belief, and we don't talk much about their blue-collar workers.
No, it's true, and I think that one of the things that this piece exposed was the idea that the bromides about fostering a harmonious workplace and, you know, collegiality and so forth.
Transparency.
Out the window at Amazon because they believe it's almost this Darwinian survival of the fittest where criticism is encouraged and there's all of this. I mean, it's pretty fascinating.
It's strangely
stuff.
Cultural revolution in the end, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, I think, again, going back to why we care, it's because we see it creeping in every workplace. And the problem is that in many workplaces, you don't have the same culture of innovation, performance, stock options, and various other benefits that allow people to put up with what seems to be kind of Stasi secret police behavior.
Nor can your data be tracked so easily.
Well, but again, in every workplace, increasingly it can, and individual metrics are seen to be a measure of larger performance. So, and the thing about Amazon that was so interesting, the piece on Sunday, was that it just is kind of this Orwellian universe. Performance improvement plan means you need to step up your game.
But one of the wonderful things about it was that the debate can go on forever because everybody agrees on the facts. It's just that one side thinks the facts speak volumes for Amazon.
Well,
all the responses were saying, yeah, we do that because we're busy reinventing the world.
Well, we have to ask, and we'll talk about this a bit later, exactly what is Amazon accomplishing in the end is a question I have. We'll discuss this in our conversation interview a bit later. But the question becomes, how do we measure Amazon and how is Amazon measuring us? And it's doing it so stealthily and full disclosure, I got an email from Amazon today just before this conversation telling me that they missed me and sending me a $10 gift voucher. So I don't know whether they've been tracking my thought patterns over the past few hours. Is that
big retailer loves you.
Exactly.
In Elizabeth Egan's novel, A Window Opens, which has been widely anticipated for various reasons, but even more so now because she is a former editor at Amazon, both the adjective and the noun are important in this. She was widely expected to come stick some sort of stiletto in the retail behemoth, and does she?
No. The short answer is no. And if you read the New York Times article, they do talk about these non-disclosure agreements, quite
That's
lengthy
true.
Ones that are signed. Clearly, she adhered to that because this novel is the story of a woman. Her name is Alice Peirce. She's 38 years old. She has 3 adorable children. She has a lawyer husband who has dropped off the workforce for a while, she has to return to work, which paves the way to a work-life balance story, which is really what the novel is about. As it happens, she gets a job very quickly. There's not the sort of horrible, rigorous screening process that discussed in the Times article of Amazon. Yeah. She jumps into this new business called Scroll, which is an Amazon-like startup company that is virtual bookstores that also sell classics. It's kind of this hybrid.
It is a weird mix, yes.
So this character, Alice, enters the workforce. And frankly, the Amazon or the workplace part of the story is pretty genteel. There's a bit of secrecy. There's a bit of instruction about the type of font that you should send emails in. There's a controlling atmosphere, but anybody who's worked within a big corporation will be familiar with this sort of thing. But what is interesting to me about this book, and I have to say reading it, it's a long book, 336 pages, but it feels like a formula. It feels Amazonian in the sense that it's based on an algorithm about what women want to read. Right. And that would be a book about a woman who is in her 30s, dealing with children, dealing with husband, dealing with parents, in this case, one who is ill, and it's quite a poignant subplot
in the story.
I know these
books are very precise in the age the children are allowed to be.
Yes, and I just felt that it was check, 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 check. It felt like a book written by committee, a very, very smart committee, but also a committee who knew exactly how this book would be positioned. And when I went on Amazon to see what, you know, customers reading this book or ordering this book were looking at, in fact, it was very extremely popular books, including Jennifer Weiner novels, and also Stephanie Clifford's Everyone Rise, which we talked about last week on the show.
Right. Well, I've noticed the fans that some of the response has been rapturous and has moved on from anything resembling literary criticism to this is my life. And she portrays it so beautifully.
Bingo, which is exactly the Amazonian kind of relatability that a lot of these books are going for. And as it happens, when I was reading the book, I had this kind of niggling sense as I was starting it. I was thinking, this is too much a template. Then I hit page 119, and Alice, the character in the book, is talking about the ideal Scroll character. Now listen to this, and this strikes me as being a big template for a lot of literature out there right now. Not just this book, but if you look more broadly, a lot of books are just trying to adhere to this formula. So this is the character described, the ideal character customer for Scroll. She's between the ages of 25 and 45. She lived in an urban or semi-urban environment with her partner and one child or more, and a substantial pet classified as a dog or cat, which she pampered with organic treats and high-end accessories. She drove a practical car but splurged on extras, navigation, roof rails, remote starter. She washed her hair with economy shampoo but splurged on face cream. She shot for apparel at Anthropology and Taylor Loft and Banana Republic, and for home goods at Williams Sonoma, Room and Board, and West Elm. She subscribed to an average of 3 publications. She consumed an average of 3 books a month, etc., etc., etc. And it is exactly like a dress from Anthropology or a sofa from West Elm. It is something that is tasteful, that's acceptable, that is not going to reframe your idea of anything. It's just going to be like a nice warm bath. It's
bathed in affluent. Does she hit the right brands? She makes no misstep in the brands?
No, absolutely bang on. She drives a Honda. It's like a little template for how she wrote the book.
And the people who love it, well, Scroll refers to a physical book as a carbon-based object. And the people who do love this thing are those who move carbon-based books, otherwise known as booksellers. They seem to have lined up behind it en masse.
Well, it romanticizes books. And who's reading books doesn't like to have them romanticized. And this character, her best friend owns a bookstore.
She chose her house to be close to that bookstore.
Exactly. But the best friend sort of disappears in the terms of the plot, which struck me as kind of a nice metaphor
for what Amazon's doing to book retailers.
She fell off the page. I don't know what happened to her. I just sort of, and at the end, I thought, what happened to her and her bookstore?
What happened to that indie store?
They were having she was having a bit of trouble, and they did have a bit of tension, which was pretty much the only tension, I have to say, in the book. This was not a high tension book.
I noticed the husband struggling and turns to beer.
Well, he seems
so anodyne.
He's dabbling with addiction, but that's not really. It's a very comforting book. It's a good piece of furniture at West Elm.
Well, what I've seen so far in early reviews is people want to welcome the scroll parts as an assault on Amazon, but it's all very mild-mannered and all comes out well. But I think they're trying to find some sort of Amazonian assault in there, and they're not finding it.
Well, I do think, again, you know, she will benefit from any remote fascination with this company that has a grip over our lives, but we don't quite know what's going on inside of it.
Yeah, anything that large is going to start appearing in popular fiction everywhere. And Amazon, especially in the book world, just looms.
Well, it's the book world is still waiting for the X-Acto knife.
That's right. Someone whose non-disclosure agreement has run out. Okay, we're joined today by Ed Nawatka, Editor-in-Chief of Publishing Perspectives, who has covered the book business since 2000. He responded to the New York Times expose, and even more so to the responses to it, by writing his own in Publishing Perspective, in which he looked at Amazon as possibly becoming Ouroboros, the snake that swallowed its own tail. So can you tell us why you were moved to do that, Ed?
It's been an ongoing story for 15 years now with Amazon, and you just really get the sense that this is a company that has almost megalomaniacal ambitions, and we've seen that come to fore nowhere else more so than in the book business itself, which what I like to remind people is that when you look at history and you look at some of the rhetoric that's been uttered, and it's certainly Amazon's not the only ones guilty of this kind of rhetoric, there are just so many echoes from the past which indicate that this is not a sustainable path to continue on. You know, I like to say that when people worry about Amazon taking over the world, I also like to remind people that, you know, in the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire still existed, and we don't talk about that anymore either. So
I'm curious to know what sort of evidence you have harnessed to suggest that, in fact, this path might be one to demise.
Well, I think that this article has given us a kind of glimpse of a culture that has almost nothing to do with the culture, if you will. But also, I have a long enough memory that I also used to manage several bookstores in a chain called Doubleday, and that was bought by Barnes & Noble at a time when Barnes & Noble was expanding, and the rhetoric was that Barnes & Noble was going to destroy.
I was going to say, better than the Ottoman Empire is the big box bookstores, whose day has come and gone.
Exactly. And it's a matter of, I think, a bit of historical perspective. I mean, ultimately, Amazon is itself a logistics company. And, you know, already you have competition coming from overseas that has looked at entering the United States and competing directly with Amazon on logistics. But I mean, we're also looking at a book business where, you know, the two best-selling, you know, the top of the bestseller list is dominated not by actual books, but by coloring books, and has been for some time. So we're certainly looking at a business that I personally think has, you know, has a lot of questions surrounding itself as a business and what its, you know, what its moral and or cultural obligations are.
I was interested in what you said about the how Amazon shapes taste. Could you speak a bit more to that point? Or is shaping taste? Is coloring books and the Harper Lee novel examples of that, or do you see more happening there?
Well, I do. I think coloring books are a perfect example of that. Because Amazon is ultimately and has been using books as more of a branding exercise, and certainly they've been accused at various times in its history of selling them as a loss leader, simply to get people to come to the online store. Amazon would love for you to buy a coloring book and a set of, you know, high-end Faber-Castell coloring pencils. This is how the profits are made. But as they squeeze publishers more and more for marketing dollars, for placement on the website, on the literary side, in a completely different area of publishing, one that I've written about quite glowingly over the years, and this is not very well known, Amazon is arguably the biggest publisher of translated fiction in the United States today. This is one part of their publishing enterprise that has worked. Arguably, you know, they and Dalkey Archive, which is a very literary publisher, are neck and neck for the amount of titles published. And people often ask me, well, why is Amazon publishing a half a dozen Icelandic fiction titles? Well, it's a loss leader for them. It's also very cheap marketing. It's much cheaper to buy the rights to translate and to publish digitally and print on demand an Icelandic mystery novel than to take a single ad in a Reykjavik newspaper. And so certainly when somebody wants to buy something, very specific item that they perhaps can't get, you know, at a reasonable price in a country like Reykjavik where everything is imported, Amazon comes to mind. They've right. gotten the publicity. They have front of mind space. And it's sort of directly attached to, I think, their translation program.
You say you have friends there, or had friends. They may have cut you off, or they may have left. But you have friends there for a while. And do they tell you things that sound even worse than the Times article?
I think if you talk to, I've talked to my friends, and they will allude to it, certainly. Often they're very afraid to speak directly to a journalist, even as a friend.
Right.
But I have a lot of friends who work in Seattle, you know, who are very familiar with the organization, spend a lot of time around the people, you know, have relatives. And I've heard 95% negative and 5% positive. And it really depends on the type of engagement that they have with the organization. I mean, there are several people who've gone to Amazon who were very prominent book people who have stayed there, who I have never heard from again, but from my understanding are very, very happy because they have had very, very good careers for themselves. So you'll have a 5 to 10%, you know, ratio of people who really, really rise to the top and I'm sure are catered to, taken care of. It's the other 90% that you worry about.
Well, there's this great line in the piece, great or awful, depending how you look at it, which is that, this is the New York Times piece, that Amazon is where overachievers go to feel bad about themselves. And I think on one, we've got this kind of paradoxical sensibility about Amazon. It was reflected in your response to it. On one hand, you have this company that's being depicted as incredibly inhumane. Yet on the other hand, you have almost a role model for other companies who may not even be as successful, but who maybe see that as a way to succeed. I wonder if there's any way that the inhumane company is just one of self-obsolescence by its very nature. What do you think?
Well, that's the question, right? That's what is going to be the end result. Amazon is a logistics company, ultimately, and it's about delivering product. Is there going to be another company that's going to rise to meet that challenge? You know, certainly there, you know, like I said, there are several companies, Alibaba being one of them, you know, that thrives against competing against a company like an Amazon.
So the happy takeaway in all this is we are liable to survive it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Ed, and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
And that brings us to Louise Penny, the Canadian author, writing Magic Realism, Studies of Evil in the Eastern Townships. First off, congratulations. 10 years now.
I know. I can't believe it. It's like I blinked. I feel like, is it Ichabod Crane or who was it who went to sleep and then woke up and the world had changed? And
there's 400,000 copies of this book. Is that more than normal or usual for you?
No, each year it grows. Thankfully, okay. Because obviously that's what you want. It's we're gaining audience all the time. There's a really nice, wonderful community that's built up around it, and there's word of mouth. As, you know, I'm sure, as you know, there's really not much of a writing career if people aren't talking about you.
Right. So this is the most ever, then?
Yes.
Okay. And your popularity in the rest of the Anglosphere is very high. Okay. You have a large American and UK readership?
Yes. My largest readership, I would say, well, I wouldn't say I know for sure, is in the U.S., even on a like a per capita or percentage basis. It was a bit more of a slow burn in Canada, interestingly enough.
So what do the appeal to the Americans?
I have a very, very good American publisher, and they understood what the series is, that it's not a cozy set in a tiny village in Quebec, although it is that, it's on the most superficial level. that in fact it's an allegory. The first couple of books were still positioned as cozies, but then they clicked in very quickly and repositioned them, and I think that helped. I think there's a fascination with Quebec. I was quite clear throughout the series, but certainly at the beginning, that I wanted there to be no doubt that it wasn't set in some anonymous U.S. village or British village, that it was set very clearly in Canada and in Quebec. And I think while a lot of publishers and agents, and especially at first, before I was published, when I was sending it around, said no one would be interested in a mystery set in Canada, the fact is they are. People find Canada interesting.
Well, especially when you get to combine so much of it here, where it doesn't look like the U.S., like an Ontario village would.
No, it's definitely Quebec. But I'm convinced that if I as a writer feel passionate about the place I live, that's what people respond to. It is absolutely Quebec. I think that's a big element. But I think what people are also responding to is it's really about all sorts of things and not necessarily murder. Right. That's probably the least of the things that these books are about. But among them is a sense of, a very keen sense of belonging. And I think that there is a real yearning out there for that sense.
Okay. Well, whether or not these are cozies, you have the eternal problem of all cozies, which is a death rate that would take, you know, seem to demand massive government intervention or at least a full-time Sûreté detachment. And I mean, your characters frequently refer to the sanctuary Three Pines provides. Mm-hmm. Well, if you get over this little hump, right? If you survive the cull every year.
I've been very influenced by Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Isabel Allende in that sense of magical realism. It was intentional bringing that sense of almost the mystical to this village that absolutely exists, but it's only ever found by people lost.
Right. Well, I like the way you handle it very much, that it's both charming and effective, and it's kind of meta, too, right? Mm. I mean, the characters make it very clear the place doesn't exist. Every book, they talk about how you can't find it on a map, and you only come there if you're more or less meant to be there, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The English and the French are sort of indistinguishable. Like, I can't tell what language anyone is speaking at any moment. They all...
Which is great.
They all belong together
here in the township.
So, you know, however ingenious the puzzles, and they are very ingenious, you're openly pointing to the core of your stories all the time, which is what lies beneath the mask.
That's right. The books are, as I said, about many things, but one of them is duality, and that again was a village that exists but doesn't exist, a pretty village. But God knows what is happening behind the closed door. The beauty of the seasons that if you blink, they will kill you. But the kind people who have rancid thoughts, as we all do.
There's a famous remark in one of the Sherlock Holmes stories when they're heading off to the country. Holmes tells Watson that, you know, there's nothing in the blackest corners of London that could equal what happens out here in these bucolic valleys.
Yeah, there's a line from, not a line, but something Sister Préjean said, who, of course, works with condemned prisoners in the States, and she said, and I quote this in one of the books, that no one of us is as bad as the worst thing we've done.
But you, part of this reason of looking under masks, I guess, is you're now, you seem very committed to openness. You talk about your past history quite freely, and is that what, you know, gave you insight into looking beneath masks?
For sure. Very little happens in the books emotionally that I myself haven't felt, including murderous thoughts. I think the more I know as a writer, the more in touch I am with myself, the good and the less savory parts, the more I own them and own up to them, the better writer I am and the better I am able to reflect that in the characters and in their choices. And in how they feel about things. I mean, it's like poetry. Poetry isn't words, it's feelings. And that's what I'm hoping. Anyone who reads my books with just their heads and missing three quarters of the book, it really needs to enter first through the chest and make its way up to the head. I actually tried to write a historic fiction book first, the best book ever written. That failed.
When was that set?
That was when I first quit work. That was my. That's why I quit work, was to write about this event in Quebec history that I found really fascinating. I might go back to it eventually.
Okay.
But I couldn't do it. And I realized I was trying to write the wrong book. But the reason, what made it the wrong book, was the wrong reason. I was trying to write a book to impress other people rather than just for the joy of it. Finally, I got it. I understood that if there isn't joy in it, then why bother? And so I wrote a book I would read. And this was shortly after 9/11, at a time when I think a lot of people were feeling quite frightened and displaced and yearning, longing for that sense of community. And that's what I infused all my fear, but also all my love.
Another note that goes through your books is surprise, I guess, surprise of what's found in people. You frequently mention that that's the look on a victim's face.
Yeah.
That's,
yes, not fear, but surprise.
Yeah, that they've never realized. They don't know what they know. They don't realize they're representing some sort of mortal threat to the person who's just killed them.
Yeah, I think that is, for me, I don't understand how murders set in villages are automatically painted with the cozy brush, when for me, living in a village now, if and when there's a murder, it is so horrific and such a shattering event that it makes people question themselves and their neighbors. And that's the surprise and that's the shock. And that's what I try to communicate, is that this isn't a pebble skipping across the surface of society. This is a great big boulder falling into a small pond. It is earth-shattering. And that's the surprise in the victim's eyes. It isn't necessarily that they're about to die. It's who did it to them.
It's easy for me, now this may just be fanboyish of me, but it is easy for me to imagine little bits of you in the recurring characters. And it's, I guess the easiest way to find out how much of you is in Claire is to ask you if there's any bits of food in your hair right now.
Actually, I just scrubbed down. I just picked it all out. No, but there is a lot of Clara in me. Not necessarily, although I run my hands through my hair, which is why I can never have I never do have a nice hairdo. I always look like I've been recently electrocuted. But I'm not sure that there are bits and bananas in there. But yes, I'm Clara. I'm definitely Clara. Most the one I most resemble, although I wish I could say it was others, is Clara. Her yeah, certainly that insecurity about her art, and yet her willingness, I hope, it's reflected in me too, of taking risks. That's, you know, that's one of the things I love about this, about, again, the duality of appearing to write a village mystery, but it's not a village mystery.
If it's not a cozy, how would you describe it then?
Well, I think I would call it neo-traditional. And not even that. You know, I think one of the things that I find odd, and always have, because while I've read mysteries, it never occurred to me that there were subgenres. I just read whichever appealed to me. I don't understand this need to categorize, to say, well, this is a cozy or a police procedural or a noir or a psychological thriller. One of the things I've tried to do is, like, my life isn't joyous, and neither is it wretched. And neither am I jealous all the time, and neither am I happy. I am a bundle of all of those things. And that's what these books are. There are elements of the village mystery. There are elements of traditional. There are elements of the police procedural. There are elements of literary fiction, of poetry, of...
Yeah, and they're very funny, too.
That's right, of humor.
Though your cop seems kind of impossibly perfect sometimes. Am I the only person who he reminds of Jean Beliveau?
Jean Beliveau?
Yeah. Just somehow that's how he looks like to me.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid,
you know,
I thought...
For me, he was actually inspired by Romeo Dallaire.
Oh.
Both in terms of, slightly physically, that sort of that large person, sort of imposing. But certainly, I mean, if Romeo Dallaire is perfect, then so is Gamache. You know, he is as flawed and as perfect and as human and as troubled.
I know, but one of his perfections is the way he admits error.
Yeah, he's so, and people say that part of that's one of the ongoing themes in I think every book they talk about it, that there's a certain hubris about him, that he feels he has more insight into the human condition than perhaps he really does. Gamache believes that evil has its limit, and that if you sift through evil, eventually at the bottom you'll find good. That's Gamache's blind spot, and out of blind spots, terrible things come. And in fact, as the series progresses, you see the consequences of Gamache and of those close to him.
What brought Gerald Bull to mind for you?
A bit of a legend in this area. It was such a remarkable story. When I heard about it, I just sort of ferreted it away. I like being able to take these events from Canadian history, recent history, or a long time past,
right,
and discuss them, because I think there is this tendency to think that Canada doesn't have history and doesn't have criminals and doesn't have odd things happening.
Well, one of the appeals of the books is the deep Canada history that's in them, from Champlain through to the Loyalists.
Even the name of Three Pines comes from the United Empire, the Loyalists. I remember being fairly early on, I was somewhere down in the southern states, and I talked about I talked about where Three Pines got its name, and the Loyalists coming across, and the woman at the back raised her hand and she said, "You do know that we don't call them Loyalists."
That was Louise Penny, author of the Chief Inspector Gamache Mysteries. You've been listening to the Bibliopod for the weekend of August 21st. Find new episodes at macleans.ca and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and BeyondPod. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. Theme music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music is by Salman Gatke from his album Under the Red, White, and Blue. Thanks to Michelle Turingan, Anne Lavery, and Scott Metcalf. If you like this, leave us a rating on iTunes. And check out the Macleans Politics podcast, On the Hill, and our pop culture podcast, The Thrill. Thanks for listening.